Community Connections. CPMS. Local sounds, thoughts, passions, and success. Celebrate local. Your neighbor's got a story to tell. Community Connections.
Happy Monday, Waterloo Region. You're listening to CKMS Community Connections for the 13th of July, 2026. High five to Adrian Farugia, who's in the studio with me.
How are you?
Pretty good. And speaking of high five, listening to the song called High Five, the piece from Adrian's album Ricochet.
That's correct.
Back to talk to Adrian in just a few minutes. Adrian Farugia playing High Five on the piano. Called High Five because it's in 5/4 time, you were telling me.
Yeah, that's right. A little foray into odd meter jazz.
No, I couldn't tell.
Cool. That's a good sign sometimes.
Why is that? Why is it a good sign that I can't tell the time signature?
Oh, well, I guess I just mean because sometimes if the music is flowing in a certain way and it doesn't deliberately sound like it's been placed in some sort of odd meter, then it's a good sign, meaning you might have just been grooving along with it, not really noticing that it was in some sort of strange off meter. So,
Sadly, we were talking to each other while the music was playing, so we didn't.
I've heard that a million times.
I've only heard it maybe twice. So. So very nice. You're a pianist. You're a composer. You're a jazz musician.
Yeah.
And you're teaching.
Yeah. I've always been a teacher. It's strange. I mean, I started piano when I was about 12 and started teaching beginners when I was 15. So, but yeah, teaching's always been a big part of the equation for me, for, you know, selfish and unselfish reasons. I get a lot out of working with students who want to learn the music, and I've found over the years having to learn how to, you know, look at somebody else's situation and assess what they need, and then learn how to articulate specific concepts or various things of that nature. It deepens your own understanding of the music. But, I, you know, my greatest passion is still to sit down at the piano and play music.
To play.
You know, often by myself or with a band.
Okay.
But I feel lucky to have that blend of things.
It's not your regular music course. You're teaching at Wilfrid Laurier.
Yes.
And it's, you're not just teaching music. There's, describe the course.
Well, it's a faculty of music. And that distinction, many music programs in 2026 in Canada are departments of music within a faculty of arts. The fact that this is a faculty of music, it's kind of like a self-governing little pocket of the university, and so there's a lot going on there because of, I guess you could call it faculty status. I would say Laurier is probably most famous for its music therapy degree program.
Okay. I've heard of that.
Yeah, and it's, you know, one of the few programs in North America, if not the world, that, you know, offers all the way up to a, like a doctoral level of music therapy. And music therapy is a fascinating field because it's obviously younger than psychotherapy, or but it does fall into the bracket of a type of therapy. And there's been a lot of really fascinating science in recent years about how, for some somewhat mysterious reason, the place inside of our mind that music occupies has some unique qualities to it. Like you know, one of the more famous examples of how music therapy works that some people might be able to relate to is that I know there were some viral videos of like working with Alzheimer's patients where, you know, you'd have somebody who had late stage Alzheimer's and they don't even recognize their wife of 55 years anymore. And then all of a sudden they put a set of headphones on and they play a piece of music from their youth. And suddenly they know their wife again, and they know her name, and they get up and they start dancing with her. And, you know, there are usually there's some real tearjerker YouTube videos out there. But so it's a really fascinating field of study. So that's a big part of it. Laurier just celebrated its 50th anniversary. And for the first 50 years, it's been primarily a classical-rooted program, you know, so classical performance, opera, some very rigorous and deep theory sort of inside of the world of academia, like, you know, some very deeply rooted classical roots. And I guess in recent years, there's been some expansion just to open things up to a slightly more diverse set of interests. And big change in this past year has been that they started their new CCM program, commercial and contemporary music. Suddenly, there's jazz music happening at Laurier and some of the more popular styles. And I've taught for a lot of years. I've taught post-secondary music since 2002.
Mm-hmm.
Started at Mohawk College in Hamilton and kind of moved around a little bit. York University, University of Toronto, Humber College.
Okay. All Southern Ontario.
Yeah, and then for the last 3 years leading up to being here was in Antigonish, Nova Scotia, teaching at St. Francis Xavier University, St. FX. That was quite a change for me, being somebody who grew up in Southern Ontario. I found myself in a town of 6,000 people in the northeastern tip of... and it was
and
great.
Just teaching piano technique or composing?
It's a little broader than that. Definitely teaching piano, but also teaching improv and in some cases what's called ear training and theory, kind of everything within the realm of that stuff.
That sounds completely contradictory to me. You know, one of those military intelligence ironic statements. Teaching improvisation.
Sure.
Improvisation is spontaneous stuff. How can you teach that?
Yeah, that's a great thing to bring up, because I think it's one of the hugest misconceptions around what improvised music is. And it's also, unfortunately, one of the biggest reasons why there still seems to be a mindset in our culture that somehow there's a lesserness to improvised music. Oh, in the eyes of a lot of people, I think they still really idealize, like, sort of the dedicated, learned classical approach where you have to toil painstakingly for countless hours to work up a score to perform. But here's the reality of what high-level improvisation actually is. It actually requires a vast skill set on one's instrument, a level of technical mastery on the instrument, easily comparable to what's required to be a concert-level pianist. Now, on top of that, there also needs to be a very, very deeply rooted grasp, understanding, and ability to apply all of the theory, all of the theoretical musical concepts. Mm-hmm. So think of it like a language, right? We're improvising right now with language, but if you think about all the mechanisms inside of your mind required for you to be able to do this, it's vast, right? You have a grasp of an entire language, which has words that have definitions. You speak with nuance. You know, it's quite complex, right? It's like that. So there is an element of spontaneity in improvisation, mm-hmm. but you're never making anything up.
Right.
Instead, you're sort of tapping into a broad skill set, and you're applying it in a spontaneous way in the moment to, you know,
right,
suit the circumstances.
And still to be tuneful, rhythmic.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously I think some people think of a certain kind of jazz, like that sort of free jazz where you hear a lot of bleeps and blurps and piano players slamming his elbows down on the low range of the piano. And
sometimes
the drums are making all these wacky sounds. But I mean, and that is a type of art form within improvised music. But I'd say a lot of what you're hearing when you think of sort of the more mainstream of jazz is this musician's playing a composition that's pre-established. It has a chord progression. It has a melody. It has a song form. And they're using that as sort of a blueprint or a foundation, right, or a stepping off point to create within that together. So often what you're hearing is actually a combination of improvisation with non-improvised things, you know?
Okay, yeah, I've always thought that people who can improvise on music mm-hmm. have to have way more talent than just being able to play something by rote. I know that when I can...
Yeah.
Play one or two tunes badly on a piano, but I could not possibly improvise. My fingers can only move in that certain pattern because that's what I have rote memorized to play.
Absolutely. One of my favorite musicians of all time, pianist Bill Evans, kind of considered one of the great pillars of 20th century music.
Mm-hmm.
One of his more famous quotes was he said, "Jazz music isn't a style of music, it's a process." And what he meant by that is, you know, what's fascinating about looking at like a high level classical musician and a high level jazz musician is a lot of the basic skill sets are identical. It's really the process in which they use those skills. I would never argue one being superior to the other. That would be like taking two great authors or something and saying one's superior to the other because of what they write about. They're both using the same language.
Different topics, different styles of writing,
right?
Different audiences.
Yeah, and different disciplines ultimately. And what I think is awesome about that is that there is a lot that jazz musicians can and do learn from classical musicians and their disciplines and vice versa. And back to the Laurier topic, what's really exciting to me about this program and what makes it truly unique from my own experience of programs I've been involved in, it's the only program I know that doesn't have the classical and contemporary, non-classical, or jazz, or whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have them siloed. It has them integrated together. So, you know, I've been teaching like an improvisation class for 20 years. This past year at Laurier is the first time ever that I taught an improv class that was equally populated by classical majors and contemporary majors. And it was so fascinating because it adds this new layer of learning, because now you've got the sort of rock R&B jazz guitarist watching how the classical pianist approaches it, okay. and vice versa. And I think this kind of blended learning model is amazing. And I think it has the potential to create a level of depth and well-roundedness in students that okay. that you can't when you've got students of the same discipline siloed all together.
Right. You just want to perpetuate what already exists if you have everybody of the same mindset.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like the preaching to the choir kind of thing. Like, it's good to sometimes have a little bit of this.
Right.
But it's been really neat to be a part of it. And I think for the students, it's got its challenges because it's asking a lot of them, especially in their first couple of years where it's truly the right. blended learning. As they move further through the program, they specialize a little bit more right. and they silo a little bit. But yeah, it's a fascinating environment. And I mean, I'm learning a lot being there okay. and meeting some really cool people that I wouldn't have met in just a sort of
It's odd that you'd program. Be teaching jazz and improvisation in a commercial music course, because I would think commercial music is, you know, rock, pop, hip-hop, and jazz and classical doesn't fall into, at least not a highly lucrative commercial music.
Yeah, right. I mean, if you think of the sort of, and I know Laurier would never try to model this, but the Berklee College of Music in Boston is like the most famous commercial music program okay. in the world. This idea of commercial music is that most of the disciplines that you would find in rock, funk, gospel, blues, R&B, hip-hop, even country, are actually rooted in jazz music.
Okay.
Now, I think what's typically called jazz in 2026 is a pretty broad amalgamation of all those things and its own unique things. But I think there's a sort of an idea that if you study jazz theory, if you study jazz rhythm, if you do jazz ear training and learn jazz harmony, learn the chords and all the mechanics of that music, you're quite well equipped to go and play in a funk band, a rock band, an R&B band.
Okay.
You know, it's a little known fact that John Williams, probably the most famous film composer of the 20th century, Star Wars Jaws, E.T., all that. He started off as a bebop jazz pianist.
Really?
Yeah. His very first album, if you look it up on YouTube, you would never in a million years guess that that guy became John Williams. Yeah, it might seem a little strange, but it actually makes a lot of sense for jazz studies to sort of be a filtering point. You know, it's kind of like chef school in a way. Like, you would go, well, it seems weird that a Japanese chef who specializes in teppanyaki would study French cuisine. But, you know, there's that sort of mindset. Well, no, when you're studying the culinary arts, you kind of study everything to get that broad knowledge, and then you filter that knowledge into a more... So,
because every culinary type has the same basic roots, you know, chemistry, physics.
Right. And that idea that somehow studying French cuisine is ultimately going to make you a better Japanese teppanyaki chef. The broader influence coming in is going to somehow deepen your understanding of, you know.
Okay, yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. So it seems to typically work well, you know. And the interesting thing is, I would say probably the vast majority of music students who study jazz don't become jazz musicians. Many of them just become really well-educated rock musicians and pop musicians and film and video game composers.
Yeah, that seems to be an up-and-coming genre of musical occupation, video games.
Yeah, and from my own sort of anecdotal knowledge, I would say there's a strong majority of people writing film and video game music in the world today who have their roots in sort of what you would typically call a jazz performance program.
As commercial music, are you teaching any of the commercial aspects of being a musician, you know, marketing and royalties and things of that nature that aren't strictly musical in themselves?
So what's cool about this program is it is a new program. So as of this coming fall, we've got the students who were the first years last year moving into their second year and a new batch of first year students. So a lot of courses are being added and developed as the program grows. Right now, there are some courses like Introduction to, you know, Music Production, for instance. So in 2026, a lot of people are making albums at home. They're not spending $160 an hour at a professional recording studio. So, you know, there's a partnership with Metalworks in Toronto, which is a high-level, top-notch recording engineering school. So some students in this program have the option to do their third year as sort of a co-op at Metalworks. Things like that. There are most definitely business of music courses that are developed and further ones that are in
development. Are they under the Faculty of Music?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah, absolutely. So addressing those things with students, like how do you write a grant application? How do you book a tour? How do you promote a new album? How do you promote yourself?
All the things that are out of the wheelhouse of a musician.
Yeah. Marketing skills, things like that. So those are all available as an integral part of the degree program.
Right. You've got quite a reputation as a composer.
Oh.
From what I've been...
What kind of reputation?
A good one. You seem to be in high demand for doing compositions and stuff. I mean, from what I can tell, what the internet's telling me at any rate, is composition a part of commercial and contemporary music?
Well, it certainly is, and... It can be in many different shapes and forms. I mean, I'd say one of the primary ways that it's an integral part of commercial jazz is just that there's more of a culture of writing your own music in those styles. I mean, you know, again, if we do this sort of classical comparison, I could presumably build a pretty significant and lucrative career as a classical performer and never write a single piece of my own and
become famous and beloved
for interpreting the music of Bach or Debussy or whatever. Whereas, so there is this sort of expectation of your own original music, definitely in the world of jazz and R&B and those styles. But then there's also, you know, something I would say barely dabbled in, but it's been very cool, is writing what's called production music. The modern way that so many areas of the music business work are quite different than traditional. There used to be this idea of, wouldn't it be cool to get your song in a movie?
Yeah.
Whereas in this day and age, most of the music that's being drawn upon for film and television is written for that specific purpose and then put into these massive banks of licensed music. And then, you know, you're a filmmaker, and you're making your film, and now you're at the point where you and your music director are wanting to insert music to give it that thing. And you're going into these massive production music libraries, and you're going, I want something that sounds like, you put the prompt in, 1960s Miles Davis.
Okay.
Cool jazz. You know, or 70s Jim Morrison. Rock, and you'll suddenly get presented with like literally hundreds of tracks of music.
And these are composed by humans, performed by humans. This is not some. You're not prompting an AI to generate.
Well,
this stuff.
Well, that's a whole separate conversation. Oh. That's changing the business. But this is music composed by humans.
Okay,
I've done a couple of these albums, and it's been exciting. The most recent one was. There was a documentary that came out in the last year called I Am Joe Frazier, and it was a feature-length documentary on the boxer Joe Frazier. I can't remember what network it was on, but I wanted to see it because my dad was into boxing as a kid. I actually remember seeing the Muhammad Ali documentary When We Were Kings, and I loved it. So anyway, I wanted to see this new Joe Frazier. I'm watching this new Joe Frazier documentary, and suddenly there's a scene where they're showing footage of like back in the 70s, and he's a young guy in New York City, and this piece of music starts playing. I get this weird feeling, and I'm like, why does this sound so familiar? I wrote that. Suddenly I heard my own tune.
Oh, wow.
And it was so exciting. What's not exciting is when you get the paycheck, you know?
Yes.
That's another big part of how the music business has changed. Okay. I did an arrangement of Jingle Bells on a bunch of production music Christmas tunes, and it was sort of a funky 1960s Herbie Hancock kind of vibe of Jingle Bells. Well, it got used in an Amazon ad that was popping up on Snapchat, Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook.
Oh.
And it had, I can't remember the exact number, it was something to the effect of like 1.6 billion unique hits. So in other words, like my little arrangement of Jingle Bells got heard by at least 1.6 billion people. And you would think, oh, wow, so have you bought yourself a small island and a private jet? It's like the payout was shocking.
I know.
No one's getting rich in the old days, like where you heard about the guy who wrote "Fly Me to the Moon," and he basically retired after writing that one tune. He became a millionaire in the 1950s off of Frank Sinatra, and he retired and enjoyed a comfortable life. That just doesn't exist in the same way now.
No. When you wrote those production pieces, did you write them for a specific purpose at the time, and it was just put into the library of all production music?
Yeah, it was working with a really amazing guy, a musician named Ross Hardy, who has a music production company called Hard Music, and this is what he does. He sort of curates and commissions collections of music, so if you were to go on their website, you would see many different... My series was called Jazz Vinyl, and... You know, it's supposed to be sort of slightly old school jazz. And it's been neat to hear where that stuff has popped up. Sometimes where you'd least expect it.
Always nice to hear your own stuff being well received.
Yeah, or even just being used, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, absolutely. But as far as, like, I wouldn't consider myself a serious composer like some people. There are musicians who identify as a composer, and that's the work they do primarily. I would say I'm a performer who composes as well.
Okay.
I get someone like at Laurier, Matthew Emery. He's a composer. Like, he has a large catalog of works, but I love composing. I mean, it's the most wonderful feeling in the world to sit down and start playing around with something and find something I really like and go, hey, that's mine. I just came up with that.
You've released albums of the works that you've composed.
Primarily original compositions,
So the most recent one we have in our library is Ricochet.
Oh.
Is that the most recent one?
Actually, no. I think you had mentioned that you have
Blue Dharma and...
Blue Dharma is the most recent of the ones you have. Yeah, that's a duo with a really great saxophonist from New York named Joel Fromm. Right. I had never done a duo album before, so it's just piano and saxophone. It was really neat to get to do that.
Which is not production music.
Not at all.
Not at all.
No. We recorded that in New Jersey at a studio there. That's a jazz album.
a jazz album.
It's jazz piano and jazz saxophone, and it's kind of intimate conversation.
So if that were to be picked up by a production company for music, it would be used as music as part of the scene, not necessarily just music to round out the background.
It depends. It could be. That does still happen, that someone hears a piece of music and they say, I want to use that. And now that kind of licensing is a little different, and it does pay a little better, too.
Oh, good. Is there a piece from there you'd like to play?
Maybe the title track, Blued Dharma, which is an anagram of one of my favorite pianists. His name is Brad Meldow. That's his name all jumbled up.
Okay. Blue Dharma from the album Blue Dharma by Adrian Farrugia. Thank you. Blue Dharma by Adrian Faruja. And Joel Fromm.
Joel Fromm, yeah.
Yeah. Is it difficult to work in a duo?
Well, it has challenges, for sure. You know, a duo like that, for instance, like I don't have a bassist or a drummer to sort of provide that support. So, you know, I would also imagine that it's probably more of a challenge for a listener, too, because it's a lot more elastic and ungrounded in some ways. So you'd have to be listening from a different angle, almost like listening to it as a conversation rather than...
Okay. Conversation is interesting because even though Joel is playing, you're still playing in the background.
Right.
But when the focus is on you, Joel is completely silent.
Yeah, or just playing very
punctuated
small
notes,
little interjections. Yeah. So there is this still sort of the roles of like the piano being sort of the accompaniment and providing the foundation underneath. But I find it highly rewarding, especially with the more exposed music gets, the more it can be incredibly rewarding with the right combination of players or incredibly disastrous with the wrong combination of. And Joel's someone I've gotten to play with a fair bit over the years in another musician's band, my friend Ernesto Cervini, who's a great Toronto drummer. We've been in a couple of Ernesto's bands together over the years. The most recent one's a band called Turboprop.
I have to get Ernesto into the studio sometime as well.
Yeah, that would be great. He's a lovely human and one of my best friends and one of my favorite musicians. But so, yeah, me and Joel go way back. It was really great doing this album with him because it felt so natural and it felt so easy in some ways. Okay. And because of that ease, it gives you the courage to push the boundaries a little bit and go some different places. And
Got a couple of other albums in the works.
Yeah, so one that just came out, another longtime musical association, originally a Chicagoan, is that the right term? Chicagoan?
I think so. Yeah.
Now living in Boulder, Colorado, a trumpet player named Brad Good. And we have a band, I'm in his band that's a bit of a sort of a pinch myself kind of band because it's with all American guys and it's with like some legends like Ernie Watts on tenor saxophonist. Okay. I mean, this is the only person I know who has played with Thelonious Monk and also played on Michael Jackson's Thriller album, like, and everything in between. Like, he's been a household name for me since I was a kid.
Okay.
And to get to play with him is an absolute dream. And then, yeah, the rest of the band are no slouches either. New York drummer Adam Nussbaum and bassist Jay Anderson, who... He's another one of these musicians. He's so humble. I just recently discovered he played on my favorite Tom Waits album, Frank's Wild Years. Jay Anderson bass. But anyway, so Brad just released a brand new album on Origin Records. It's our first album with that band that's a live recording. So we were playing in Madison, Wisconsin. And the album's called Live Your Dream. It's got a couple of my tunes on it, which is exciting. And then the other one is an album I've been talking about doing for over a decade with one of my oldest friends, a bassist named Chris Jennings, who's originally from Calgary, Alberta. And we met in Toronto as U of T students. And he's been living in Paris, France for the last 20 years. And he got us this great opportunity to record in this cool studio, Riverside Studios in Cologne, Germany. So got to go and do that a couple summers ago. And we're still working on getting the album out, but it's fully recorded, it's mixed, it's mastered. So it's...
What's taking so long?
Busy musicians' schedules, we'll just say that.
Okay. So Jennings have a direct hand in the mixing, the mastering?
We all have. Yeah. So it's been a collective thing between me, him, and the drummer, Patrick Goriger, who's a drummer from... And then, of course, the studio itself. But yeah. We've called our band Eurostar, which is a bit tongue-in-cheek because it's named after the high-speed train that goes around. Yeah, I'm really excited to get that album done because the reality is when you've got a new album, it does afford you one thing, which is to book some gigs, book some concerts, book even a tour. Yeah. So it's just really to have that album on hand is an excuse for us to get together and create some playing opportunities.
Yeah.
So. I'm sure we'll certainly be doing something at the Jazz Room when the time comes. So
that'll be good.
Yeah.
But Larry Larson coming back in at the end of August to talk about the upcoming schedule. Yeah.
Larry's one of the most wonderful humans I know.
Yeah.
He's just such an amazing force in the music scene, and it's so great that he's has a hand in booking that room. Yeah.
And other upcoming concerts this weekend.
Yeah. Friday, firstly, 17th,
yes. Mm-hmm.
At 3:30, I'm playing with my incredibly gifted wife-to-be, vocalist Jessica Lalonde, and her quartet.
Okay.
We're playing at the City Hall stage for the Uptown Waterloo Jazz Festival.
Yeah, behind City Hall.
Yep, that's the one. And longtime bandmates Ethan Ardelli on drums and a bassist named Dan Fortin. And I will say that we do have a very special guest who's going to join us for a couple pieces. So if you're the kind of person who likes a little bit of mystery, come out. And
you're not giving it away here on the radio.
I'm not going to give it away. And then I have my own band on Sunday, the 19th. And that's at 1:30 p.m. And that's with bassist Roberto Acapinti, who's been a longtime friend and jazz uncle to me, and drummer Ethan Ardelli, again. Alto saxophonist Allison Au, who is a true phenomenon. And I think she's the only person I know who, she won a Juno for her first two albums in a row. she's this... and then, the sort of extra special guest is we're bringing in Brad Good, the trumpet player I mentioned earlier. Uh-huh. And he's coming in from Boulder, Colorado to join us.
Oh, wow.
Just shout out to Derek Hines, who's the music director for the festival. He does his job with such grace and generosity. And, I'm really grateful that he gave me this chance to do a slightly larger scale thing by having the funding to bring in world-class American musician for the festival.
Yeah. Sounds like that's an overwhelming job, putting together a jazz festival like that. I mean, it's one thing to book you for an evening in a single venue.
Yeah.
But to book 7, 8, 10 more groups over the course of 3 days all in a row.
Yeah.
That's overwhelming.
However hard we think it is, it's even harder.
I'm sure.
Just the balancing act and the. But I think these are very important cultural events for communities, just to have these things to be exposed to and to experience them together, It's like the Winston Churchill quote when one of his generals said, we need to cut arts funding to help bolster our forces. And Winston Churchill apparently said, cut arts? Well, then what are we fighting for?
Right.
Yeah. So I do think it's an important part of any community. I mean, of course, we need a place to get our cars worked on, and we need a place to buy groceries, and we need all that stuff. But we need these things too. Yeah. And I really cherish, anybody who's committed to making that happen in any community.
Yeah. And yet, we've been seeing overall the decline of events like this. I mean, we were talking about this earlier. Jazz Festival used to have two stages, one on the public square, one.
Yeah.
Behind City Hall. Now we're down to just the one behind City Hall, which is, in my opinion, a bit of a bonus because you're not missing out half of the performances that are taking place.
Yeah. The reality is that in order for these things to exist, it's an effort by everyone involved. There are sponsors. There are corporate sponsors. There are private donors. There are musicians. There are many volunteers at these festivals. But then there's the audience. And that's really the final, you can't. And I do think in this age of technology, and I know some people turn off their ears when you start hearing people talk about the age of all, because it just seems to get talked about so much, but there is some truth in it. It's making it for some easier to not have to actually engage with the rest of humanity in a real human way. But I have faith. Because one of the cool things I get to do as a 51-year-old is work with a lot of 19 to 24-year-olds as a teacher. Right. And I'll tell you, anybody who's like those damn Gen Z kids, I actually feel a sense of defensiveness for them. Because I think they're a wise generation that's getting wise to certain things and saying things like, no, I don't want a smartphone anymore. I want a Nokia flip phone, and I want to go hang out in real life with real humans. And they're the ones sort of reviving the vinyl music movement. Yeah. But, you know, I just think that there are a lot in that generation who are starting to see that basic value of human-to-human interaction. And I have a lot of faith that they're the ones who are going to keep the world functioning the way it needs to function.
Isn't that just a very select group that you've picked out there, the people who are coming to your courses to learn contemporary and commercial music and playing jazz and learning improvisation? That's
fair enough. I'm always going to be seeing things through the filter of the music world. But it was even fascinating to read an article about looking at playlists, Spotify playlists. Okay. I mean, that's maybe more of a universal thing. You know, whether or not you're a hedge fund banker or a farmer, a lot of people have streaming music of some sort in their life in this day and age. And it was really fascinating to read that the youngest generation, I guess they're calling them Gen Alpha now, has the most diverse playlists in their collections.
Oh, that's good.
So, you know, my mom might have lots of Beatles, some Elvis Presley, and a little bit of Yanni and ABBA. Whereas what they're seeing with this generation is in one of their playlists, you'll find a Mozart concerto for clarinet, and then you'll find some Snoop Dogg, and then you'll find some Chapel Roan, and then you'll find some John Coltrane and some Miles Davis, and then you'll find some Tammy Wynette, and then you'll find some strange music from Kyrgyzstan. So it just seems to be an openness or a curiosity, and it's almost becoming hip to be diverse, and
It's taken me decades to work through multiple genres. Grew up listening to classical music because that's what my parents listened to.
Right.
You know, electronic music because that was the technical thing to do. And I'm a bit of a propeller head that way.
Right.
Into jazz, my most recent passion is metal.
Right.
So, but that's, you know, I'm older than you are even, and it's taken me that long to go through, you know, five or six genres of music.
Yeah.
To hear that the young folks are mixing it all together, you know, in their first couple of decades of musical experience is quite incredible.
I think so. I think it's becoming less about identifying. Our generation would derive identity from the genres of music that we subscribe to. It would even affect how we would dress. Whereas I think they're sort of maybe turning their nose up to that notion, and it's becoming more about, well, why do you have that second movement of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony in your playlist? And their answer is, because I heard it and I liked it. And it didn't matter to them that it was a classical piece or a... To me, I think that's incredible because that is what music should be about. Does it speak to you on a personal level? Does it make you feel something? If it does, you don't have to justify to anybody why you like it.
To be a bit contrarian, isn't that shallow?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's funny to look at it that way because I could almost say in a weird sort of way, that's the deepest relationship you could have to music, which is to strip away all of the notions about genre and fame and just really be able to listen to a piece of music and go, I like it. I identify with it. It gives me a feeling that makes me enjoy hearing this. That's enough. That's enough for me. I mean, you know, I wonder sometimes, like, did I listen to Duran Duran when I was in grade 6 back in the 80s because I actually liked it, or was it just because all my friends liked it and it was the hip music and it was being hyped heavily by Much Music?
But also, you didn't have access to the vast array of streaming services that you could pick and choose what you wanted to listen to, had pockets full of change and could go out and buy the stuff.
Absolutely.
So maybe there's some good to those streaming music services after all.
Agreed. I think when used well and wisely. You know, and it's interesting because if someone says, how do music students in 2026 compare to music students in 1996? Mm-hmm. I think the best students now are leagues better than we were in 30 years ago.
Technique in
everything.
Appreciation.
Just every area of music. But interestingly, I would say the overall level is lower now. So what does that tell you? Well, what it tells me is the ones who are going to excel are always going to excel. And they've got a lot more tools available to them now. And so the ones that are really committed, they've got so much more now to work with that they are excelling to greater. But I also think that in a world of convenience, it can also breed some negative things.
Right.
Let's just call it what it is. Laziness entitlement. Mm. My students are shocked when I tell them when my teacher told me to go check out an album when I was in school, that meant going to the Hamilton Public Library, and if they didn't have it there, and chances are they didn't have it there because I was into jazz music, I would have to take a GO bus from Hamilton to Union Station in Toronto, and then I would have to either take the subway or walk up Yonge Street, and I would have to go into Sam the Record Man or HMV or Tower Records, and I'd have to spend $20 to $30 in 1994 on a CD. And so when they say I didn't get a chance to check that album out this week because I was busy, I'm having none of it. Because, right. I mean,
that doesn't happen.
You don't even have to get out of your pajamas to do it.
Yeah. So encouraging everybody to get out of their pajamas. Go out to the Jazz Festival starting on Friday.
Yeah.
What time are you playing on Friday?
3:30, I believe. Jessica Lalonde, she's opening the festival. I think she's the first. She's the first show. And you know, for those of you who like other things, there's food trucks.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of goodies, and so it's an event worth checking out.
I'll be there. Awesome. Thank you, Adrian Ferrugia, for coming in, talking about all kinds of stuff today.
My pleasure, Bob.
CKMS Community Connections for the 13th of July. My name is Bob Jonklin. Be back next week.